I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Rebecca Goldstein. She is a philosopher and a novelist. She's a MacArthur Fellow, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a Guggenheim Fellow, a Radcliffe Fellow, and most recently a Miller Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute. She's the author of many works of fiction and nonfiction, and her latest novel is called 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So I just have to ask you this to start with. Why do you think it is that human beings are not only so preoccupied with, but so emotional about the question of God, which you could make an argument for really doesn't take up religious practice, really doesn't take up that much of our day?
Yeah, I think we humans want to situate ourselves in this universe. We want to know where we are and what role we play in the universe at large. It's not just philosophers, it's not just scientists. I think everybody wants to have a sense of where we are, who we are, what we're supposed to be doing with what we are, and what's ultimately in store for us. And the questions of God are a way of dealing with this. Is this a universe that cares about us? Is this a personal universe at large? Or is it completely impersonal and, you know, utterly indifferent to us? So it comes from this very deep, I actually call it that it's part of being human that we all have an ontological urge. Ontological means, you know, the questions of being. It comes from the ancient Greek ontos, being. We all have this. We have this ontological urge to just know the nature of the place where we found ourselves, this universe.
And although some people don't so much,
yeah,
and no
yeah.
other animals seem to. So it's kind of odd.
Yeah. I really do think at some level, after the basic needs of survival, you know, being fed and being sheltered are met, and you feel safe enough in your life, that these questions, they arise. And they, you know, you look at ancient people and they have their forms of worship, and forms of worship seem to be involved in almost every culture. And all of these are ways of orienting ourselves in the largest sense possible. Like, where are we? Does it care about us? Does it care how I live my life or not? And, you know, we formulate these as questions of religion, but they're very large existential questions that I think are almost part of being human.
And so people answer them in so many different ways, and those ways have to do with their culture and their individual personality to some extent. But the thing that's also so odd in a way, if you pull back and think about it, is that everybody seems to care what somebody else's answer is to this, and they get very emotional about it.
Yes, and that's because we're all so uncertain about it. I mean, we're reaching beyond what we can empirically verify when we come, no matter what we come to, no matter what answer we come to, we know that it could be wrong. There's no test that we can run. There's no mathematical proof that you can derive that's going to tell you that you're right. So we're on uncertain ground, and yet it matters so much to us because it matters to us as much as our own selves matter to us. Are we living our lives in the right way? And the very uncertainty of our answers make us very insecure. So when people have different answers to these ultimate questions, it arouses insecurity and defensiveness, and things can get ugly, unfortunately.
Well, one manifestation of that, and I really deeply think it takes all kinds to make a world, and if everybody were one way, it would be very, very bad. So I don't want to single anybody out, but one group that I think is very strange is atheists when they have so much contempt for people who aren't atheists. Where's that coming from? I mean, why does, I mean, have you seen this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I know the leading players in the atheist movement, and you know, and I like them, and but I disagree with the emotion that they bring to the task. I think, you know, people have asked me why did this movement of the new atheists, why did it break out at the moment that it that it did. And of course, 9/11 had a lot to do with it. The dangerous aspects of doctrinaire belief have certainly had something to do with this. Also, the advancement of the biological sciences and the psychological sciences that we, especially evolutionary psychology, that we now have a way of explaining religious belief, and they would say explaining it away. The other aspect is the erosion of separation of church and state in this country, the attacks on that separation, and the thing that you hear over and over again, that without God, there can't be any moral life. And, you know, one of the reasons why it's so dangerous for any politician to say that they're not a believer, because how could you trust somebody who's not a believer? And I think that that has slowly built up a lot of anger among non-believers. It's, you know, one of the worst things that you can possibly say about somebody, that they're amoral, that they have no moral sense, that they can't be trusted. So there's been a sort of angry pushback against religion, and I think that's partly what's motivated this. You know, I'm not going to deny that there's also arrogance on the side of some non-believers, thinking they don't know what it feels like to be religious, and to them it just seems stupid. And that's where I part company with them. You know, I think that the religious answers are one possible way of trying to come to terms with these large ontological questions. It doesn't have to be stupid.
I have met people who were raised in a church of one kind or another, and they searched their souls, several people like this, who are very good friends and whom I love very deeply, who searched their souls and found out that deep, deep inside they were really atheists. Mm-hmm. And I have met other people who grew up in agnostic or sort of atheistic households, and at a certain point in their, you know, young or not so young life, they found some kind of spiritual center that was really profound for them. And I wonder if there isn't a kind of, what would you say? I mean, some people also find that they have a gift for playing the violin, or some people find that they're really good engineers, and whether there isn't just some kind of natural tendency.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, you know, I do think that we have there are differing philosophical temperaments, philosophical personalities, and when we approach these questions of how to orient ourselves in the universe, these personalities are sort of coming into play because we're going beyond what we can empirically know or, you know, or prove. So a certain kind of temperament would confine themselves to, you go no further than what can be empirically proved. You believe what science tells you and you don't go anymore. And you even go so far as to say there can't be anymore. Anything that exceeds empirical verification can't exist. That's, you know, that is itself going beyond what science tells us. Science doesn't proclaim about itself that it can answer all questions. But there, you know, there are temperaments, and that's what naturally occurs. I'm more or less like that. I'm of that sort. I'm a naturalist. I tend to believe what science tells me, and I don't want to go any further. I you know what Newton said, I frame no hypotheses. I've always resonated with that sentiment. But it is a kind of sentiment. You know, there are personality aspects that are going into this, I think. Other people, you know, they love mystery.
Right.
They vibrate. It stimulates their pleasure zones when they're confronted with mysteries. To other people, more naturalist disposed like me, mystery is profoundly annoying. I don't like to be presented with things that I can't understand. I want to be able to understand things. So, you know, there are these deep differences among us. I think you're right. I think it takes all kinds, and it takes all kinds to come up with these various views of what's the nature of the world that we're living in.
I do think that, so for example, because I search myself and I'm like, what kind of a person am I when confronting these questions? And I think in terms of mystery, I'm willing to let certain things sit as mystery, like where did that little pellet come from that exploded into the Big Bang? I don't know. I'm happy to never know. I don't really care that much. I'm happy to have it be a mystery, and I'm happy if other people want to build a religion around that little pellet. I'm not really that interested in the mystery of cancer. I would like it to be cured.
Right, somebody
to figure it out. And I feel like each of these ways of seeing maybe is a tool that has appropriate use.
I know, I agree. But as I say, you know, that I think this is part of our human nature, that we want to situate ourselves in the largest way possible. And since we can't really definitively answer these questions, different temperamental differences come into play. So I actually have this acronym, you know, that N-A-T-U-R-E, which actually spells nature as in human nature. And the N is are the naturalizers. And mystery tends to bother naturalizers very much. It's just, you just don't want anything to exceed human powers. So when faced with really difficult questions, like the question of free will, which is a quandary, you know, free will and determinism. In fact, all I could list all the questions that we are most concerned with in philosophy, and they're philosophical because we can't answer them. We can argue one way or the other. We can refine our intuitions, but we can't come up with a definitive answer. As reasonable as your point of view is, somebody can come up with a point of view which is just as reasonable that you know, is contradicts your point of view. But naturalizers like to transform all questions into ones that can be empirically validated one way or the other, or to make the questions disappear. That's a ploy that's often used by philosophers. The A is aestheticizers, and they tend to, the most beautiful answer is the answer that they respond to. And, you know, truth is beauty, beauty is truth. And
does that come up for you as in your fiction?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not an aestheticizer. As I say, if I'm anything, I'm, well, maybe I should go through that.
Okay.
The because there are two that, well, there are three that kind of fit me. And I don't think, you know, I think in different problems, different aspects will come up. And the T are theologizers. And when faced with these big mysterious questions, like why is there something rather than nothing, or free will, or the grounding of morality, they'll turn to God. That God is the one mystery that absorbs all the other mysteries. And the U are unsolvers, which doesn't sound like much of a technique, but actually in philosophy, to prove that none of the other techniques make the problem disappear is hard work. And I tend to be an unsolver. I'm very stubborn about certain problems. I think they're real philosophical problems. I don't think we can make them disappear.
Meaning solve them.
Solve them. Or translate them into strictly scientific problems.
Like fate and free will.
Exactly, like fate and free will, the hard problem of consciousness. Why is there something that it feels like to have this brain, or to be this brain, in fact? Why? How does a subjective experience arrive out of this, what we call the hard problem of consciousness? It's a real problem. It's a philosophical problem. So to resist the attempts to make it disappear is to unsolve. The R, the reifiers, they just create a new realm of being to absorb the philosophical problem. So with the hard problem of consciousness, it would be to be a Cartesian dualist. And the E, and I think at the closest to what I am, is an epistemologizer, to say, look, the reason these problems are so mysterious is they're kind of beyond our pay limit. We've got these brains that evolved in order to deal with certain problems. And it's not that the problems themselves, these philosophical problems themselves, are intrinsically difficult. Their difficulty is because of the cognitive equipment that we've been bequeathed by evolution. And so it's more to concentrate, when you're faced with these problems, on the mismatch between what our brains are designed to do and what these questions are asking our brains to do.
And that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the crux of the whole problem, in a way, because we are these primates. We see colors, but we don't see things that are outside of our range of light spectrum.
Exactly, yes.
Other animals see different things, and
right,
they see it in different ways.
Yes.
We perceive certain sounds and not others. All of our senses are within limits,
absolutely,
within limited range that have to do with evolution.
We see a continuous visual field. You know, that's how we experience the world. That's all being put together by our brain.
And yet, we think there's such a thing as objective reality, and we'd like to know what that is.
We're dying to know what it is, because our, you know, here we are, and what's going to become of us? And do I really have a self, and can that self survive my death? I mean, this is, it's no wonder that there are very, very strong emotions that are brought to all of this.
Well, it is, and again, it's so strange, because as primates, what we really are having strong emotions over is mates, food, territory, and things like that, which of course people are always having fights and strong emotions over.
Yeah.
But this sort of like, why we should feel so, I think about a lot, why we should feel so strongly about whether truth is beauty, or what the objective nature of reality really is.
Yeah.
Or why, and maybe it's just the primate parts of ourselves that are misplaced, wants to smack somebody upside the head when they disagree.
Well, you know, here, we are the animals who know that we're animals. We're the animals who have self-consciousness. We're not just experiencing this world as all as all animals do. Not just, but we are aware of ourselves as experiencing this world. And we're aware of ourselves. We have a concept of ourselves. And so our primate psychology that wants to be able to survive and to flourish and to do well is also concerned with the beliefs that we have, you know, that how we're acting in this world. We can choose, or maybe we can choose. There's the problem of free will,
right?
It feels like we can choose. There feels like we deliberate over our behavior. We're faced with all sorts of moral quandaries. And we want to do the right thing, and we wade through so much uncertainty. So we're not just any old primate. We are primates with self-consciousness and deliberation, and
all that stuff that's on page one of the Old Testament.
Exactly, you know, and therefore, you know, a tremendous amount of existential dread and uncertainty, and all of this comes into play with the questions of, does God exist? Is God telling us? Was God so good as to give us, to write down for us the right recipe for the right life, or, you know, or not? And so all of this is coming into play.
Now, what, in your view, are the various, or in your experience, because not one thing, what are some of the various things that people mean when they say the word God?
Yes. It's a good question, right? So, for example, I am a student of Spinoza, of the great 17th century philosopher Spinoza. You open up the Ethics, he talks about God, God, God all the time. But his notion of God is so unique, so eccentric, that he was, in his own day, accused of atheism. And, there's good reason for this, because he did not have in mind the notion of God that most people have, and certainly that the Abrahamic religions have for, you know, what they mean by God. So he was definitely a heretic and he was excommunicated by his own Jewish community of Amsterdam. So yes, this word varies very, very much. When Einstein, by the way, was asked, he was asked by a rabbi. Einstein was coming to the United States for the first time, and a rabbi whose name I remember because it happened to be Goldstein, Rabbi Goldstein, telegraphed Albert Einstein, "Do you believe in God?" Because Rabbi Goldstein had read various things that alarmed him as to whether Einstein was a believer in God. And Einstein wrote back, "I believe in Spinoza's God." And that was a very kitschy way for Einstein to, the man had brains to get off the hook. But anyway, I think what most people mean by God, and what atheists who are, you know, arguing against the existence of God have in mind, is one, a force that brought everything into existence, that not only created matter and energy and space and time, but also the laws of nature. So that, you know, when we ask, why is there something rather than nothing, which I think Leibniz first asked, he put it in those words, those who are saying, you know, God, are saying, you know, this is the explanation, the thing outside of the universe that not only brought the universe into its existence, but imposed on it the laws of nature that scientists study. So there's that. I think people also often have in mind a notion of the grounding of morality, that God is good, is the paragon of goodness, and that we are good to the extent that we are created in God's image. And there is no notion of goodness or morality outside of that. So that's a second aspect that people have in mind when they talk about God. I think also when you look at the particular religions, there's also the notion that this force enters into human history, that this force has some sort of intention for us, for humans, wants us to live a certain way. I mean, that's sort of implied in the notion that God is the grounding of morality, but that also, you know, that there's a reason that somehow revolves around us, that God created this universe in the way that he did.
And especially with us in it.
Especially with us in it, and maybe so that we can learn of his existence, as some religious people say. But that also enters into history. And there's where you find, so far, all the religions agree. And they would agree on this, you know, or at least all the Abrahamic religions, you know, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But the narrative they tell of the way in which God entered into history, that differs between these religions. And that's where they really contradict one another and often are quite angry with one another. So, you know, for the Jews, it's that God chose this people. And for Christians, it's that his son returned to earth to redeem us, to redeem our sins. And, you know, and for Islam, it's that Muhammad was a God's representative on earth. So very different stories they tell about how God enters into the flow of history, but that he does enter in, yes, these religions agree. So I think these are the core beliefs of religion.
And it seems like somewhere in some of those, there is a protective and loving God and a sort of father figure,
yes,
or parental,
yes,
figure enfolding us little children in his arms and that kind of thing.
Yes, but for some forms of religion, it's a punitive, angry, scary God, you know, Calvinist, for example. It's a fairly, you know, you're elected before you're even born, and nothing you do will actually make any difference. You know, it's a scary God, and you know, the God of the Old Testament is, you know, I am an angry God, I am a jealous God. So there's that aspect too, and I think here too, you know, even among religious people, you know, I've been talking about all these various personalities that enter into, you know, whether you are a God believer or not, or an aestheticizer, a theologizer, a naturalizer, an epistemologizer, but within religion itself, if that's your way of coping with these large existential questions, I think the force of your personality also imposes itself on, you know, is it a loving, friendly God?
And what were your parents like?
Yeah, you know, all of that history. I mean, does it make you feel at home in this universe, or does it make you feel quite frightened in this universe, watching every step you take? William James writes about this in his magnificent book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And he was, I think he was somebody who always wanted to be a believer but wasn't. You know, you spoke about these sorts. And I think that his father was a Swedenborgian mystic, and other contemporaries of his father described him as a kind of religious genius. And I think William James, he was a naturalist. He couldn't help it. It was his temperament. But I think he wanted to be a religious genius like his father and to have that kind of mystical experience. But he writes about the different sorts of religious personalities that there are. There's this kind of sick soul, melancholic religious personality. And then there's the joyful,
right,
life-embracing, universe-embracing religious personality. So even within the religious personality, there are many different kinds of personalities.
Exactly. Which correspond to just many kinds of personalities.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're talking to Rebecca Goldstein. There's so much more to talk about. Maybe we can get back to it in the time we have, but I want to talk to you about novel writing, fiction writing. It seems, as I was reading this book, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction, I felt so much happiness while I was reading it, because I'm not probably going to read a book of philosophy written by an academic who's teaching at a major institution, but there's so much in here that helps me think about things. And it's all grounded in these characters, some of whom I love and some of whom I love to hate.
Right.
And it just brings up this question for me, which is something that you must have been, that you must be working with and have been working with all the time that you've been writing novels, which is, how do you share what you know? What are the different media teaching academic writing, novel writing?
Yeah, no, I think about that all the time. And I wrote my first novel, The Mind Body Problem, you know, when I was 26. I had just become an academic philosopher. I just got my doctorate. And it was not a career-wise. It was a crazy, risky thing to do. You know, there were and still are so few women in philosophy. And I was doing philosophy of science. There were so few and still are so few women in that. And here I was, this young woman. I write a novel, but I'm so convinced that we all, you know, think about these questions all the time, not just professional philosophers, and that if you're devoting your life to thinking about these things rigorously, then you owe it. You just owe it to the community of humanity. I mean, that sounds grandiose or something, but you just owe it to, if you've learned anything at all, to find a way to share it. And since we all care, we all care so deeply about these questions. So I was, you know, I wrote a novel about this question, the mind-body problem, you know, which is this hard metaphysical question, and wanted to embed it in our lives, because it is embedded in our lives. We're always thinking about these things. So yeah, so this has been like an ongoing experiment on my part to find different ways, even in the nonfiction, which is meant for, you know, there are some things I write that are just meant for philosophers, but mostly that bores me. At this point in my life, the challenge is to find ways of making what I'm thinking about accessible to everybody. I'm so committed to, if you really understand it, then you could explain it to anybody. It doesn't have to be somebody who's had your training.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm committed to that in the sciences, in math, and in philosophy, that there is a way to make it accessible.
And so you, I'm guessing, bring the rigor of your academic training to these books. The real arguments, there's this wonderful debate in the latter part of this book, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, where one of our main characters, whom we love, debates this neoconservative for and against the existence of God.
Yes.
And some of the things that you've been talking about in our conversation right now come up, like where does morality come from, and
yes,
so on. And as I, the layman, am reading it, I'm thinking, how would I respond to that? And then the other guy talks, and it's a beautiful response. And then, how would I respond to that? And you do it for us, and it's so satisfying.
Oh, thank you. No, I'm not leaving my mind as a philosopher or my life as a philosopher behind when I write these books. But something else is coming into play, you know, to write a novel, to create real characters. Somebody actually at the Santa Fe Institute, the physicist David Pines, I think he was one of the original founders of the Santa Fe Institute, said that he considers, you know, my novels philosophy by stealth.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, even if you think you're not thinking about philosophy, you suddenly realize, yes, you are. You've
yeah.
been thinking about it, and here, you know, and it's going on. And as you engage with these characters, you're somehow engaging with philosophy. But I really want the characters and the story and the plot to stand on their own, you know.
Which they do. And I mean, one of the things that I have for both movies and novels is I have to love at least one person in it.
Yes.
Otherwise, I don't like it.
Yes.
And so you, thank goodness, give us some people that you can really love. But it's also, I mean, I think it does something which is part of the whole enterprise here, which is it reminds you that there is a subjectivity in every idea. No idea stands on its own in a disembodied way. So somebody says something and it's a really big idea, and then they go eat.
Yes, exactly.
Or go get rejected by somebody.
Exactly.
Or fall down.
Yes. And, you know, or fall in love, you know. Yeah. That I do feel it's like our whole self, sense and sensibility, our history, our genetic endowment, and just the experiences we've had, everything is brought to bear on all of these questions, you know, who we fall in love with and where we want to live and how we want to live and how we orient ourselves in the world in terms of these large questions. And here's the thing. That's how philosophy started. Plato wrote dialogues. He embedded these questions in real people, in settings, in real situations. You know, the Euthyphro, one of the early dialogues. It's a great dialogue. And, you know, here's Socrates, and he's waiting actually to go into the courtroom where he's going to be put on trial for his life for asking these questions constantly in the marketplace and rejecting the commonplace answers and getting people to think about these questions and to question their own answers. And he's actually going to lose his case, and he's going to be, as we all know, is the great story. He's going to be put to death, drink the cup of hemlock for his activities. But as he's waiting, here's another guy who's bringing a court case, Euthyphro, this young guy, and he's bringing his father up for charges of murder, for impiety, for accidentally killing a slave. And Socrates says, "Oh, you're just the man I want to ask these questions to, because I've always been wondering, what is impiety? What does it consist in?" So Plato situates these questions, these deep questions that he's asking really for the first time. He lays out the whole philosophical territory. He creates it, or he brings it up out of the deeps like Atlantis, which is actually a myth that he probably is responsible for. He talks about it in the Timaeus. But anyway, he animates these questions in real dialogues, in real situations. He shows us that they matter. So I think that's where philosophy began. And it's not a betrayal of philosophy to write about it in a narrative setting and trying to show that these questions are really questions that are always there behind our activities and our choices and our experiences and the way we experience life in general.
I wanted to ask you another question about the idea of progress. So in science, maybe we can kind of agree that there's progress because things build on what came before, and the case has been made, and you've made the case, and others, that morality is progressing in the sense that even when it happens, we're horrified by torture and slavery and things like that in a way that we weren't 150, or many of us weren't 150 years ago.
Yes.
And not everybody is now, but the numbers point toward progress.
Yes.
What about philosophy? Is there progress?
Yeah.
Or are you just like doing fate and free will and time and space and all that stuff century after century?
After century. You know, there's progress in the sense that philosophy is always dependent on science.
Is it?
To a certain extent, you know, we have to take, so the questions, the philosophical questions about time, for example, we now, when we talk about them, we have to take into account relativity theory and what the scientists are telling us about time. And that's not irrelevant to the questions, the philosophical questions of time. You know, free will and determinacy, it's not irrelevant what we're learning from MRIs, and it's not irrelevant. Evolutionary psychology is not irrelevant to these questions. We have to take all of that into account and be thoroughly versed in it in order to discuss these questions intelligently, these philosophical questions intelligently. All that being said, you know, the questions nevertheless still remain, and taking all of the scientific evidence into account, we can still pose these questions. We pose them somewhat differently because of what science has taught us. So I would now, you know, when I talk about time, I would talk about it, you know, partly in terms of what relativity says about time as the fourth dimension. So in that sense, you know, there's, because we piggyback on science, there's a kind of progress in the sophistication with which we can discuss these problems. But by and large, you know, the way that Plato first posed the problems, they're still open questions. We can refine them, we can formulate them much more in much more sophisticated language. We can make our case ever more sophisticatedly, but somebody else is also going to be making the case very, very sophisticatedly. The one place where I think there really has been real progress, and it's made a difference to the world, is what you broached on in when you first asked the question. I think in moral philosophy, there's been tremendous progress that we, you know, just as there's been scientific progress, there's been moral progress, that we actually can understand things morally better now than we have. What moral philosophers have tended to do was to demonstrate to us that there was an inconsistency somewhere in our moral reactions that we feel very strongly about when our own group is treated wrongly. What is it about our own group that allows us to feel this, that justifies this? If we can isolate this, we can see that other groups manifest exactly the same grounds. If there's some reason that your group can't be treated in this way, and you isolate this and you formulate it, then if you still want to say that, you know, other groups don't matter, it doesn't matter if you treat them this way, you're guilty of an inconsistency, and philosophers will demonstrate this. In our own day, for example, animal rights has become a very important topic in philosophical debate, with people like Peter Singer and others demonstrating to us that, look, you know, if you feel this way about the human species, try to formulate exactly what it is about the human species that make them worthy of being treated with dignity and not having their pain be something indifferent that we don't care about. And if you can formulate what it is about the human species, perhaps you can, he is certainly argued, there's an inconsistency in not extending this to other species. And it's a lot of work to demonstrate these things, to isolate what the grounds are, and then to demonstrate the inconsistency and not widening the grounds. It's a lot of real philosophical work that ends in people actually eventually feeling differently, because without feelings, there's no moral action.
Well, eventually is the operative
word.
It's
a long, long haul. And, you know, it was in the 17th century, you know, in the Age of Enlightenment, that philosophers, John Locke was actually, as far as I can tell, the first one, started to make the argument, the very abstract argument, that slavery is wrong. You can't own another human being. It violates what we think about human beings. And as long as you could demonstrate that these were human beings, you just couldn't treat them this way. But for people to actually become convinced, I think there has to be a critical mass of people, and it becomes a movement, and then it gets translated into real emotions. You really start feeling the pain of these others, and empathizing, you know, expanding our powers of empathy, which is, you know, an emotion. Only then does real political action and real political change take place. And it's a long haul.
Yeah, and that work of getting outside the academic departments and into the city council meetings and the legislatures and stuff. I mean, that's
exactly. But I just want to say that, you know, this kind of philosophical reasoning has a role to play. It can't do it on its own, but it has a role to play. And that's one place in which I think philosophy has actually, you know, made progress. Plato never questions slavery. It doesn't occur to him to question slavery. It's a way in which we've really made progress. Never questions war. Never
right.
questions the rationality of war. To him, it's just a law of nature. We will, both Plato and Aristotle, there will always be war. I don't think we feel like that anymore.
Yeah, they've been right so far.
But to me, it's a wonderful intellectual and moral, almost spiritual exercise to think about our grandchildren and what they will look back on us and say, oh my Lord, what were they thinking?
They thought that. I know. I think that's a really important
what were they
thing
thinking?
To do.
And I tend to feel that way about war. You know, that there will be generations that will look back and say, what? You know, this barbarism was allowed? There were laws for this sort of thing? You know, that this was just part of practice? Nobody questioned it? I think they're, I hope that future generations are going to look back and feel just horror.
So this leads maybe indirectly into another question that is very important to me, which is, and maybe it's too early to say, but has the field of philosophy been influenced by the fact that now there are women in it, women philosophers, academics, professors of philosophy, you and maybe not as many others as we wish for, but you're there in a way that you weren't even 30 years ago.
Yeah, no, I think it has. I think, you know, in its content, I think it's changed. I'd like to think it's not quite as aggressive as it used to be, but I'm not sure about that. And I think it's definitely helped. You know, if in fact there are, the more people there are who are being brought into this, thinking very, very seriously about this question, more different sorts of people there are, the better it is. You know, there are many different points of view. I think it's a good thing to have people who have given birth or even have the potential of giving birth and who think about the species in those terms. I think it's very good to have them thinking about philosophical questions.
Well, like war, for example.
I
mean, if three generations from now our great-great-grandchildren or whatever are saying, how could they ever?
Yeah.
I would have to venture the guess that it will be because women entered not only this field, but
yes,
politics and everything else.
Exactly. And actually, there are some very good statistics. There's a social scientist named, I believe, Fisk, who has gathered some very compelling statistics that is correlating empowerment of women, especially politically, with decline in rates of violence. You know, women, you know, they tend to be less bellicose. They care tremendously about the survival of the next generation. And the more you empower women in every aspect of life all over the world, the less violent it becomes. It's also very, very important for women to have control over their own reproductive rights. And, you know, that means that they're going to get married later. They tend to have fewer children. Decline in population, especially if young male population, is also highly correlated with declines in violence. Those young men with their testosterone, they wreak havoc.
Dog bless them.
Yes, exactly.
So to speak. There are, and again, I, you know, I'm not a philosopher. I can't help but think that there is
Yes, you are.
Well, that there's a gender issue in some of the things, because I've been thinking, I guess maybe like, as you say, everybody does, about the issues that you write about in your novels as well as in your nonfiction work, but things like false dichotomy, what I think of as false dichotomies, like emotion and intellect.
Yes.
And it seems to me that emotion versus intellect is kind of a guy way of looking at the world, and that women, for some reason, and maybe you can tell us what that reason is, tend not to dichotomize those things so much.
You know, I am so glad you mentioned that. I think that's one of the most important lessons that actually have come out of neuroscience. So there's this neuroscientist, Antonio Damasio. He's also a great Spinoza fan. We've been on panels together on Spinoza. And one of the reasons he so loves Spinoza is Spinoza had realized way back at the dawn of science in the 17th century that the emotions and the cognition are not separate, that they are entwined, that knowledge is a kind of emotional state, and emotions make knowledge claims. And if you're impaired in one, and this is what Damasio has been able to establish in his lab, in his neuroscience lab, if you're emotionally impaired, if something happens, you know, in a certain part of your brain and you can't experience certain emotions, you're cognitively impaired. It's going to show up in cognition. And in this great neuronal complexity, which is our mind that we're only beginning to understand, the emotions and belief systems and cognition, intellect and the passions, it's it's all intertwined. It's all intertwined. And I think where we really see this is in these large philosophical questions, that it is really there, that we're arguing, but we're arguing with our whole soul, with our emotions, with our passions. Everything is at stake here. So yeah, and oh, but your question was about women. Do women, yeah, maybe, I don't know. I've never really considered that question. If there's a gender difference here, there might
with
be.
With emotion. Yeah. Well, and you know, you think, oh, okay, if you're cognitively impaired, that affects your emotions. If you're emotionally impaired, it affects your cognition. But what about some of those, I mean, emotionally useless, brilliant mathematicians or something like that?
No. That's a very interesting, because that kind of personality is, I'm very interested in that sort of personality.
Are they mostly men?
I know there are women of this, but it's much more common among men. It's there is a high. I know somebody, a psychologist, who's doing a long-term study on correlations between mathematical ability and falling somewhere on the Asperger autism spectrum. And there is, you know, there is a correlation. It's higher among men, but it also exists among women. And these are, you know, people who are amazing, daunting in their ability to deduce one thing from another, that purely logical, you know, mathematical deductive power, but they're not very good at accessing their own emotions.
Maybe because they don't access their own emotions, or they're really not interested in that many other things, they devote more attention.
It could very well be.
I mean, the rest of us might have that ability too, but we don't.
Yes. No, it could very, very well be. But there could also be, you know, cognitive deficiencies and just not being able to read the signs of others, you know, of what they're feeling. They lack what's called in psychology a robust theory of other minds. And this is, you know, and you see this, and it's, I'm actually incredibly fond of people of this sort. I feel very protective towards them. And I've had, from the very beginning, from my very first novel, I've had mathematical personalities as my characters, you know, was in the mind-body problem. And it's in the last novel, you know, that there's this mathematical prodigy. I find it an interesting to have that much intellectual power and to be so clueless and to wander so clueless in this world is touching to me.
It's just about time to go, but can you tell us what you're working on next? Is there another novel in the pipeline?
There isn't right now. I mean, I have some ideas for novels, but I have some other projects that have to be finished before. The book that I'm working on, and that's going to be done this summer, it's actually about Plato. So Plato's much on my mind. And not only do I want to talk about Plato in the context of the ancient Greeks and why did they do everything that they did, why did everything explode in, you know, 6th, 5th century, 4th century BC, you know, not only philosophy, but science and math and democracy and theater and architecture, everything. What was it about that culture? But I also want to, here's the really crazy thing. I always have to do something crazy in a way of trying to dramatize the questions that I think we all care about. I'm writing these new Platonic dialogues, Plato in our day, talking to us and talking to us, you know, like having an MRI and talking about where the soul is. And
I
have him on Bill O'Reilly talking about whether you need God in order to be good. And, you know, with Bill O'Reilly giving him a hard time and all sorts of things like that. So it's a lot of fun.
Rebecca Goldstein, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.